I had thought of subtitling the talk that I had for today, the A Conflict of Visions, or from Bigger Thomas to Clarence Thomas, but I thought that I'd stick to the subject and hope that, some of that comes out, and certainly has come out, I think, in the words and the comments of the last speaker. A year ago, white supremacist turned Republican David Duke watched from the Senate gallery as the U.S. Senate upheld President George Herbert Walker Bush's veto of the Civil Rights Act of 1990. Grinning, Duke declared that Bush and Congress, quote, are getting my message, unquote. In the very week in November that David Duke lost the race for governor of Louisiana because of the unprecedented black voter turnout, George Bush was caught trying to slip a provision into the watered-down Civil Rights Bill of 1991 he was forced to sign that would have effectively abolished the affirmative action programs of the federal budget, the federal government. He was caught. 2 weeks later, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a Minnesota case guaranteeing constitutional protections of free speech for white supremacists to burn crosses on the yard, the affirmative action programs of the federal budget, the federal government. He was caught. 2 weeks later, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a Minnesota case guaranteeing constitutional protections of free speech for white supremacists to burn crosses on the yards of black families. Justice Scalia, the ideological mentor of newly appointed Justice Clarence Thomas, already finds the case against cross-burning, quote, the rankest kind of subject matter discrimination, unquote. We have come full circle in a year. From the grinning assurances of Ku Klux Klan Republican David Duke that the federal government was getting his message, to reactionary Supreme Court ideologues supporting Klan terror against black families in 1991, there can be little doubt that we are on a reactionary course back to the statutory racism of Plessy versus Ferguson, handed down by the Supreme Court a century ago. However, what can we expect from the moral character of the man from Penn Point, Georgia, the, quote, uppity black who deigns to think differently? This would seem more a rhetorical question were it not for the historical antecedents of 100 years ago, which disclosed that in the same year as Plessy versus Ferguson, Booker T. Washington gave his conservative accommodationist speech at the Atlanta Cotton States Exposition. Pragmatism of Washington is in no way different from the neoconservatism of Thomas. Both take the degradation of black life as their point of departure and seek its amelioration through the accommodation with the ruling capitalist forces of American society. As comforting as the illusion may be for academic fellow traveler Orlando Patterson to imagine that, quote, the sociological truth is that America is now the least racist white minority society, majority society in the world, unquote, New York Times, October 20, 1991. The ideological betrayal of the black bourgeoisie cannot conceal itself behind the fantastic hyperbole that the Thomas Hill hearings, in Orlando Patterson's words, were perhaps the single most important cultural development for African Americans since the great struggles of the civil rights years, unquote. Like Thomas, the sociological truth of America, Patterson holds to be self-evident, constitutes the crisis in and challenge to black thought that Washington instigated when he assured his white audience at the 1895 exposition that, quote, in all things that are purely social, we can be as separate as the fingers, yet one as the hand in all things essential to national progress, unquote. That strategy has not worked yet in our history. Historically, the pre-industrial America of Washington and post-industrial America today look pretty much the same to the black masses. The economic illusion of sustainable employment as a way out of the social degradation of the ghetto is short-lived. But while the social degradation of a black quote-unquote underclass is the ideological point of departure of black conservatism, its material basis is to be found in the deepening class schism within the black community. The economic and social inequalities that continue to keep blacks and whites as separate fingers on a hand has also had its counterpart in the class anatomy of the black community. Thus, according to the report of the Population Reference Bureau on African Americans in the 1990s, quote, the economic gap between poor and affluent blacks is widening. In 1989, the number of black families with incomes of $50,000 grew to more than 1 million, or 14% of all black families. At the same time, the percentage of black families earning less than $10,000 a year rose to nearly 26%, an increase of 3 percentage points, unquote. Naturally, this is over and above the reactionary prognostications of conservative University of Chicago economists like Walter Fackler, who blames the current recession that we're in on civil rights laws and anti-discrimination policies. Nor does the latest neo-dependency theory of Daniel Patrick Moynihan suffice, other than to add to the self-perpetuating disorder of the bourgeoisie. Such retrogressive returns to the old threadbare ideologies of the past can only serve to deepen the dissolution of the current state of things. The black neoconservatism of Clarence Thomas and his ideological mentor Thomas Sowell enthusiastically countenanced the view that capitalism marks the end of history. Not only do such views imply the end of black history as well, but black neoconservatives have become the conduit for the very destruction of black self-determination itself. Frantz Fanon has pointed out that, quote, the perfecting of the means of production inevitably brings about the camouflage of the techniques by which man is exploited, hence the forms of racism. Thus, at a certain stage, racism no longer dares appear without disguise, unquote. Though hardly disguised when 55% of the white electorate of Louisiana voted for David Duke, nevertheless, we have seen the black unemployed and homeless in Detroit, a city run by a black mayor, have their tent city torn down by black city police. We have seen the black city administration in Washington, D.C. brutally suppress a Latino revolt against police brutality and murder. Despite the refurbishing of a local Black Panther organization and the implementation of an Afrocentric curriculum in Milwaukee public schools, we have seen black unemployment skyrocket to 16.6%, more than five times that of white joblessness in Milwaukee. And we have watched as 25 poultry workers, mostly black, meet their fiery deaths in Hamlet, North Carolina, because the exit doors to the factory were chained shut. And we are told by black conservative economists like Thomas Sowell and Glenn Lurie that trade unions, health and safety standards, and the raising of the minimum wage is a barrier to black, quote unquote, economic progress. The reality of the meaning of black civil rights has been called into question in the Reagan-Bush era to such an extent that we are in the midst of a fundamental restructuring of the social and political agenda of the black community. The dire consequences of this restructuring at the bread and butter level of human needs are not only portents on the distant horizon, they are being felt right now. For its part, the ideological response of the black bourgeoisie has been to retreat into a black neo-conservative economism. A recent example of this was articulated by the once radical Earl Ofari, writing in the Chicago Tribune, August 20, 1991, on, quote, black conservatives' deep roots, Ofari identifies the objective basis of Thomas and his conservative ideology and the unprecedented growth of the black bourgeoisie. Quote, although the wealth of the new black bourgeoisie remains proportionately less than that of its white counterpart, Ofari explains, the fact is that thousands of African Americans have come closer than ever to realizing the American dream. This is why, he concludes, Thomas is not an abnormality, unquote. He's right. There is no doubt that there is an objective basis in the black community from which the present ideological crisis issues. However, what explains the transformation into opposite of a 60s nationalist like Ofari and the vacillation of Jesse Jackson? What, in other words, is the meaning of what now conservative black syndicated columnist William Raspberry reported earlier this summer of Jackson's speech before the NAACP National Convention in Houston, when that civil rights organization issued its equivocating response to the Thomas nomination? According to Jackson, blacks are in a lose-lose game if we oppose Bush's politics of racist polarization. Writes Raspberry, quote, black Americans, says Jesse Jackson, are caught in a dilemma that has negative consequences for our political and social economic health. If we lose, that is, if we fail to convince the nation that the Bush administration is playing racial politics, we lose. We will end up in self-righteous political isolation, exposed as racial crybabies with little influence over the direction of national policy. But if we win, if we can sell the notion that the president's actions His Willie Horton politics, his threatened veto of the Civil Rights Act of 1991, his lifting of sanctions against South Africa, and yes, his nomination of Clarence Thomas are cynical ploys to divide America along racial lines to our advantage, we still lose, unquote. Jackson's answer to this lose-lose scenario is to enter a new game, to be about the business of improving the American capitalist system so that presumably whites won't fear losing their jobs to mythical black quotas. This is the American black version of what's going on in East Europe and Russia, where the free market is now being glorified as a new stage of democracy. Thus, whether you take Thomas's bootstrap self-help ethos or Jackson's corporatism, there is a black neoconservative economism that has internalized Reaganism, Reaganomics, and begun to rationalize the racist degradation of black life in America. However, the black liberal opposition to Thomas and his ideology reflects the same petty bourgeois individualism. The liberal black refrain declares that, quote, my black background closely resembles that of Judge Clarence Thomas. We heard all of that. Or, quote, this hypocritical move by President Bush should silence those of us whose beginnings were just as humble as that of this poverty-stricken child at Penn Point, Georgia, unquote. According to the class nature of their consciousness, Thomas's liberal critics do not go beyond the limits that he does not go beyond ideologically. Both are driven theoretically to the same individualistic standpoint to which material interests and social position have already brought them in practice. The late Marxist humanist philosopher Raya Dunia Staya may have just as well been referring to today's black neoconservatives when she asked, quote, what is there in this degenerate retrogressive era that makes one mistake one's attitude for independence when it's actually mouthing something that represents some form of the old that has taken advantage of a new form of existence, unquote. Today's changed world exudes such ideological degeneracy that there is no way to keep the retrogressive developments in the U.S. and in South Africa in separate categories. The Inkathegate revelations concerning South African President F.W. de Klerk's covert funding of the counter-revolutionary Gacha Buthelezi and his terrorist Inkatha organization came on the heels of Bush's lifting of sanctions against the apartheid South Africa. To be sure, the new phenomenon that de Klerk takes credit for is, as he told a London audience earlier this year, quote, popular violence is no longer directed against the state, but between rival black parties, unquote. Bush had already wasted no time and taken advantage of the opening Thurgood Marshall's resignation from the Supreme Court gave him to solidify his judicial supremacy over civil rights, women's rights, and labor. The nomination of Clarence Thomas is also a revelation, just as the Inkathegate revelations in South Africa. This time, however, disclosing George Bush's strategy of further dividing the black community against itself in the aftermath of the U.S. imperialist war in the Persian Gulf. In short, George Bush hopes he has found in Clarence Thomas the ideological equivalent of de Klerk's unleashing of Gacha Buthelezi. Clearly, there is nothing irreversible, we should get this, there is nothing irreversible about so-called reforms or revolution in today's changed world. That is to say that the two-way road connecting the black struggle in the U.S. with that in South Africa shows any black South African looking at the current crisis in the African-American community here that there is nothing irreversible about gains negotiated with the ruling class. More importantly, the opening that allows the reversal originates within the liberation movement itself. Indeed, so deep a retrogression in civil rights today could not have proceeded so far had not the civil rights movement remained unfinished. Any social perception of black political reality which does not comprehend that risks some succumbing to the ideological pollution of the Reagan-Bush era. Historically, each stage of revolutionary consciousness contains critical elements reaching far beyond their original standpoint. Although the struggles which shape these stages of consciousness no longer assume their original historical form, they in fact constitute a critique, a thoroughgoing critique, of whole spheres of social life and institutions, such as religion, the state, and bourgeois society. The thought of Malcolm X represents one such stage of revolutionary black thought, whose initial critique of the civil rights movement reaches beyond its original standpoint to our very day, own day. In part, This is seen in the dialectic at work in the language and rhetoric of Malcolm's nationalism. It is a rhetoric which is uniquely American and wholly subversive. The political language of the dispossessed is an active and animating instrument in Malcolm's discourse. The instrumentality of Malcolm's political language was an active and ongoing confrontation with American reality. He challenged us to face reality. Unlike Martin Luther King, Malcolm never sought to translate the ethical life of American society, its dream, into the political experience of the movement. Malcolm sought the transposition, the subversion, the inversion of the terms of American values and black reality. King's aim was to identify the American dream with black aspirations, transforming both in the process. Malcolm instead sought the centrifugal force of an immediate and irresistible inversion, a turning upside down of dream and reality, values and dispossession, aspirations and revolution. The uniquely American character of Malcolm X knew, as Herman Melville did, that the American ship of state was not so much the heroic whaling ship of Ahab, but rather is more in league with the Mississippi River boat of Melville's The Confidence Man, selling black slaves down the river and bringing cotton up. Below deck, as below the surface of American society, teemed the human cargo, us, and that commodity of American capitalism that would be king, cotton. On deck, the confidence game of American democracy beguiled itself with its political masquerade. American democracy has, quote, exterminated the hunted generation of wolves, Melville wrote, which would seem the cause for unalloyed congratulation, and is such to all except those who find that in new countries, where the wolves are killed off, the foxes increase, unquote. Malcolm engaged the analogy of the wolf and the fox in the message to the grassroots. In this, his most intricately crafted prose, Malcolm recreates the historical underground meetings of Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, and Nat Turner, drawing all of us into the revolutionary conspiracy. Malcolm strikes at the double consciousness of African Americans and thereby strikes a blow at the confidence and quote-unquote trust that black folk give to America. The first thing that binds Malcolm to us, his audience, is our mutual recognition that America has a problem, a serious problem. As he says, quote, not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is us. The problem is no longer out there, it's right here, it's us. It begins inside us, with us. There's no facing of a reality of America, the reality of America, without facing the reality of ourselves, what Fanon called the fact of blackness. Nobody resents the message but a wolf who intends to make us his meal. The wolves are those agents of the white power structure, the white man. It is at this point that Malcolm comes to the crux of his message to the grassroots, namely what he calls, quote, the method that the white man uses against the Negro revolution, and he called it revolution. It was when the first crisis in national black leadership appeared in 1963, and when the local leadership, local, not national, but local leadership emerged at the grassroots level, such as Gloria Richardson in Cambridge, Maryland, that the wolf gives way to the fox. The critical moment came not with the March on Washington movement, but with the independent stirrings of the black masses for a movement, especially after the Birmingham bombings of 1965 that killed three little black girls. Malcolm found that the black masses, quote, were going to Washington, were going to march on Washington, march on the Congress, tie it up, bring it to a halt, not let the government proceed. They even said they were going out to the airport and lay down on the runway and not let any airplanes land. I'm telling you what they said, that was revolution, that was revolution, that was the black revolution, it was the grassroots out there in the streets, unquote. When it became evident, self-evident, that the national black leadership had not instigated the march on Washington, that the black masses were running ahead of the leadership, it was then that, quote, that old shrewd fox, Kennedy, comes on the scene and decides that if he can't stop the spontaneous movement, he would put the national black leadership at the head of it. Thus it has been the incipient revolution at the core of black reality, the fear that the spontaneous black revolt can outstrip the control of the national black leadership, that has transformed the wolf into the fox. Today we have a combination of both. I might call it a wox. It is the fox who frantically seeks to put black leadership it can trust at the head of black thought and black reality. From the beginning, the fox has sought to accentuate the ideological divisions in the black community. It is only with Clarence Thomas that it has assumed such an explicitly cynical form. What is absolutely crucial for us to grasp in the propulsion of the present historic moment is that the Clarence Thomas phenomena and the ideological crisis that it has precipitated in the black community has appeared in response to the ongoing revolutionary black dimension at the core of black reality. It does not manifest itself merely as a consequence of class divisions in the African-American community, although that is its context. To comprehend this revolutionary continuity is to comprehend the critical elements in the revolutionary thought of Malcolm X, which extend beyond their original historical standpoint and which constitute a relentless critique of whole areas of contemporary life and its contradictions. In conclusion, our epoch cannot be reduced to the contradictions and vicissitudes of the last several years of retrogression, as we heard in the previous panel on the crisis and socialism. Our epoch cannot be reduced to the last several years of those contradictions. On the contrary, ours has been a century of full world historic contradictory change and transformation whose high points in thought as well as in actuality cannot be easily or so easily subsumed. The revolutionary thought of Malcolm X is such a high point which has become more crucial to working out the new revolutionary beginnings for the 21st century than they were when Malcolm was alive. His thought is more crucial now than even when he was alive. Ours is the generation which has absorbed the objectivity of past and present crises and revolutions, and who has, that is our generation, has the knowledge that humanity can be free. As Frantz Fanon said in Black Skin, in the Wretched of the Earth, each generation must, out of relative obscurity, discover its mission, fulfill it, or betray it. We must fulfill our mission if we are to carry on the legacy, as was posed here for this conference, of Malcolm X in 1991 and into the 21st century. Thank you.